At this time, I want to welcome everyone to the Websites on the ADA Accessibility in the Digital Age. As I said, my name is Claudia Diaz. I'm Associate Director at the Great Lakes ADA Center. I would like to introduce our presenters for today's session, Barry Taylor, who is the Vice President for Civil Rights and Systematic Litigation at Equip for Equality, and Rachel Weisberg, who is the Staff Attorney over at Equip for Equality. At this time, Barry and Rachel, you guys have access to the microphone. You may begin.
Great. Thanks, Claudia. Hi, this is Barry Taylor. I'm going to be starting the presentation, and Rachel Weisberg will be joining us later on in the session. So welcome to the session we're doing on websites and accessibility. First, before we get to the technical and legal information we're going to provide, I wanted to make sure that people knew that if you are an Illinois attorney, you're eligible for 1.5 hours of continuing legal education credit. All you need to do is at the end of the session, not before it's over, but at the end of the session, shoot me an email at barryt@equipforequality.org, and then we'll work with you on getting your continuing legal education credit. Equip for Equality is a provider for continuing legal education for Illinois. We are not authorized for other states. However, some attorneys from other states who participated in past webinars have emailed me. We've given you a certificate, and then people have submitted those and they've gone through. So if you're from another state and would like to try to get CLE credit, please email me as well and we'll give you the information, then you can see if it can work out with your particular state. Also, if you're looking for continuing education credit, that those of you who are not attorneys but need some sort of continuing credit or some sort of confirmation you attended the session, you should contact Great Lakes directly. And you can call them at 312-413-1407 or go to their website and connect with them that way. And we'll repeat this slide at the end of the session. So as far as the outline for today's webinar, what we're first going to do is give a short background and introduction to the issue of website accessibility, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about how the ADA has been applied to Title III for places of public accommodation, talk about the definition of public accommodation, precedents, what courts have said about that, also look at websites as places for public accommodation, and then we're going to take a break because there's quite a bit on Title III, and before we finish Title III and get into the settlement agreements, we're going to see if people have any questions about the court cases that we've talked about. And then we're going to start back up again with Rachel talking about settlement agreements under Title III, and then move to other parts of the ADA, Title II and Title I, and then other laws, including the Rehab Act, and at the end give you some technical standard and resource information. So I'm sure all of you are familiar with the overall language of the ADA, and one reason we want to cite this is because a lot of times courts will cite this language, especially the goals of the ADA, that the ADA is to provide a clear and comprehensive national mandate for the elimination of discrimination against individuals with disabilities. And you'll see this particular provision quoted in a number of cases that talk about how websites should be included for coverage of the ADA. And as everybody knows who's on this webcast, I'm sure, is that the ADA has broad anti-discrimination requirements covering all aspects of our society, including private businesses that are open to the public, which again is the main focus of our discussion today, places of public accommodation. Now, if you look at the ADA text and also the ADA regulations, there is no reference to the internet or even to websites. And some people may find that surprising, but let's think about the history of things. The ADA was passed in 1990, but in 1990, it was really before the internet existed as it does today. So it's really not surprising that we don't have anything specific in the text of the ADA or those initial regulations that came out of the ADA about the internet. Let's first talk about why internet accessibility really matters to people with disabilities. As all of you know, the internet has completely altered the way most of us live our lives these days, and it really goes to all kinds of aspects of our society. One, of course, is businesses. You know, people can compare prices and order goods online without even going to stores anymore. Also, you can apply for government benefits. You can renew your identification. You can file your taxes. Also, college and universities, they let you register for classes online now. A lot of healthcare information is shared online. Test results you get from your doctor without having to go in, you can download that information. And also just purely educating yourself. You're participating in this webinar today. Many of you are doing that online rather than on the phone. And so accessibility is important to you as well. And accessibility is particularly important to people with disabilities who may not have access to accessible transportation. And it's really a link to the outside world for people who don't have that access, who may be in institutional settings or somehow otherwise are isolated. It really links them to places that they otherwise would not be linked to. But if there is inaccessibility to the website, that link is not really meaningful for them. And the Department of Justice, we have a quote here. They've called that the internet is the ubiquitous infrastructure for information and commerce. And this is part of their advance notice of proposed rulemaking that we'll talk about in a second. But basically, I think they're just telling us that the internet is everywhere and involved in really all aspects of our life. So we want to make a disclaimer here. Rachel and I are attorneys. We're not experts on technical accessibility of websites and we certainly understand some of the broad issues, but what this webinar is to focus on is the legal theories on whether the ADA applies to websites and talk about some of the cases and settlements and that sort of thing. We are going to provide information about technical standards and technical assistance at the end of the presentation. And just quickly, we wanted to highlight some of the sort of common virtual barriers that exist when websites aren't accessible. So oftentimes what we'll see is that people will try to convey content through a graphic or an image or a chart, but they don't label what's called alternative text. And so screen readers like JAWS, they can actually read text and provide audio for people who are visually impaired, but that means you have to have that text embedded into the visual image. And if that's not there, then those images can't be read by screen readers. Also, color coding content can be challenging as well for screen readers and also for people who are colorblind. Also, there can be a barrier if the content can't be adjusted by font size or color contrast, particularly for people with limited vision. By expanding the font, it can make it much easier for them to read when they have low vision. We also see another barrier when audio information isn't captioned. This can be a barrier for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. Videos on websites aren't accessible if they don't have captioning. And there are a lot of videos, obviously, on websites. Also, when people require the use of a mouse without keyboard alternatives, that can be a barrier for people, both for people who are blind as well as maybe people who have dexterity disabilities. And also, you can see situations where flashing visual content can trigger seizures. Another thing we wanted to emphasize is that it's easier and much more cost-effective to address accessibility issues when you're building the website rather than retrofitting it. Similar to buildings, it's much easier to have an accessible building at initial construction rather than retrofitting it. So it's important for people to know ahead of time when they're building websites to make it accessible right off the bat. So now let's really move to what we're talking about, and that is, must websites be accessible under the ADA? As we said before, the ADA has no mention of websites or the internet, and what we've seen over the last 20 years or so, when the litigation started on this issue, the opinions are quite different. And we're going to talk about why that is and what the different positions and theories are in the cases around the country. One thing that hasn't been differing is that is the Department of Justice's position on this. Now, at this point, they've not issued regulations, but they have presented quite a bit of non-regulatory guidance through amicus briefs, statement of interest, and settlement agreements. And they have been clear and unambiguous that the ADA does apply to websites. Now, in 2010, the Department of Justice issued what are called advanced notice of proposed rulemaking. And in that advanced notice of proposed rulemaking, they again reiterated that they believe that ADA certainly covers websites accessibility. And usually when they publish this kind of advanced notice of proposed rulemaking, they get some feedback from people, they get some questions answered that they pose in that advanced notice, and then they actually publish the notice of their proposed rules shortly thereafter. Unfortunately, that hasn't happened with respect to website regulations. The advance notice was published in 2010, and we're still waiting for the actual proposed rules. DOJ most recently set their deadlines as proposed rules for Title II for August of 2014 this year. Unfortunately, that did not happen. They did not meet that deadline. And they've also set for themselves a deadline of March 2015 for Title III proposed rules. That hasn't expired yet, but it's unclear whether or not DOJ will be meeting that deadline either. From an advocate standpoint, as well as I think from a society standpoint, that where there are some differing opinions out there, it would be great to get these regulations out so that DOJ can provide, you know, specific guidance beyond what they've already done through the amicus briefs and statement of interest. So hopefully we'll be seeing those real soon, and a lot of the questions that we raise in this webinar will be resolved by DOJ. So most of the cases that involve ADA website accessibility arise under Title III, places of public accommodation, and really turn on the question of whether the website is a place of public accommodation. And I emphasize the word place because that becomes a key component of the discussion. So we have here on this slide the definition of public accommodation from the ADA, and I'm just going to read that. It says, no individual shall be discriminated against on the basis of disability in the full and equal enjoyment of the goods, services, facilities, privileges, advantages, or accommodations of any place of public accommodation by any person who owns, leases, or leases to, or operates a place of public accommodation. So the question arises, what is a public accommodation, and does it apply to websites? So when the ADA defines public accommodation, they actually give us 12 categories of entities that they consider public accommodations, so long as they affect commerce. And these 12 categories are sort of the exclusive list of places of public accommodation. And within that, those 12 categories, there are a number of examples which are not exhaustive. So there's other types of things that can be examples. These are just ones that are listed in the statute. And what we've given you here are four of the categories that arise a lot in this litigation. Establishments serving food or drink, places of exhibition or entertainment, sales or rental establishments, and service establishments. And the service establishments are particularly important for some of the cases. You'll see the word, an example of insurance office that's going to come up in some of the cases, and also travel service, which is going to come up. So keep those two examples in mind as we move forward. So what's going to be odd here is instead of starting with talking to you about cases that involve website access, we're actually going to talk about a series of cases that came up first, and those are cases involving insurance policies and insurance cases. And the reason we're bringing these up is that a lot of the legal theories that arose from these cases were applied to website access cases that came later. So hang in there while we discuss some of the insurance policy litigation, because this analysis will be important when we get to the website cases. And really, in these cases, what usually happens are their suits are brought under the ADA because they're treating physical disabilities differently than mental disabilities under these insurance policies, or perhaps they're placing caps on certain disabilities like HIV and AIDS, which we saw a lot in the 1990s. So what happens in these cases, our courts are asked, are these insurance policies places of public accommodation? And if not, are they covered by Title III? And some courts have said that Title III applies to conduct that occurs outside of the place of public accommodation. However, other courts have held that Title III applies only to places that have physical places of public accommodation, and that they don't regulate conduct that occurred outside of the physical structure. So they require a physical structure in order to be a public accommodation. And they say if there's anything outside the physical structure, there has to be some sort of nexus to that physical place of public accommodation. So let's move on and see how these cases have come up. The first case, and this is kind of the first one that we saw in this issue that a lot of other courts rely upon or cite, is called Car Parts. It's out of the First Circuit and is out of New England. And what happened here was the plaintiff had HIV, and the defendant capped this insurance policy for HIV benefits at $25,000, but it provided $1 million worth of coverage for all other disabilities. So people with HIV had $25,000 coverage, and people with any other type of impairment had $1 million cap. So quite a big disparity. And so they claimed that was a violation of the ADA, treating one disability differently than any others. And the defendant said, no, we're not covered by Title III because a policy is not a place of public accommodation. And the lower court agreed and said, no, the ADA is not covered, does not cover this policy because it's not a physical place of public accommodation. And so the plaintiffs then appealed it up to the First Circuit, and they reversed and said, yes, Title III does apply to this insurance policy. And they looked at those 12 categories that we talked about, And they said that the examples within the 12 categories, again, are not exhaustive, they're illustrative. They're just to give some examples. And they noted that if you look at those categories and look at the definition of public accommodation, there is no express requirement for a physical structure. And so the lower court was wrong about that. And they then looked at one of the examples that I mentioned before, the travel service, as an example. And they said, you know, that's an example that shows that Congress didn't intend Title III to cover entities that don't require a person to physically enter an actual physical structure. And they went on, and we have a quote here that I think is very helpful. It says, it would be irrational to conclude that persons who enter an office to purchase services are protected by the ADA, but persons who purchase the service over the telephone or by mail or by the internet, Congress could not have intended such an absurd result. And so they also relied on that broad purpose of the ADA that we talked about providing comprehensive discrimination against people with disabilities. And if you didn't include things outside of the physical structure, you wouldn't achieve that goal of comprehensive coverage. And they again talked about how neither Title III nor any of the regulations after the ADA was passed make reference to any kind of physical requirement or physical entry to be covered by Title III. And then they continued in car parts to say that if they did exclude a broad group of businesses, that would run afoul of the ADA. Now, in this particular case, the insurance company did have a brick-and-mortar establishment, but the court didn't say expressly that a service offered off-site had to have a nexus to that establishment. We'll see other cases in a few minutes that talk about this nexus argument, but that did not arise in the car parts case. And 5 years after the car parts case, another case came out of Illinois with similar facts. This was another case challenging HIV/AIDS caps in an insurance policy. And in the Doe case, they did cite car parts favorably. And they said what's good about Doe for advocates for website accessibility is that they specifically did reference websites and not just talk about off-site, they talked about websites. And so this quote is very good. It says, the core meaning of Title III is that the owner or operator of a store, hotel, restaurant, website, or other facility, whether in physical space or in electronic space, that's open to the public can't exclude disabled persons from entering the facility and once in from using the facility in the same way that non-disabled folks do. And so again, there was no requirement of a nexus to a physical place to be covered by Title III, and the court found that Title III public accommodations covers insurance policies, and they gave some other examples like websites and electronic space that showed how broad this could be applied. So now we get to a line of other cases that talk about this nexus between discrimination and a physical structure. And this first case we're going to talk about, the Wire case, is a really important case because it's relied upon by so many other cases for this whole position. So in the Wire case, what we had here was the plaintiff was challenging a policy that provided greater benefits for people with physical disabilities than people with mental disabilities. And they were claiming that was an ADA violation. And the Ninth Circuit went a different way than what we heard in Carpart and Doe. They said that places of public accommodation are actual physical places where goods or services are open to the public and places where the public gets those goods and services. And they said that each example that's listed in the ADA is an example of a physical space or a physical place. They didn't mention the travel service analysis and car parts in this case. And they said you have to show some sort of connection between discrimination and an actual physical place. They went on to say that an insurance office, remember that was an example in the different examples of public accommodations we looked at before? They said an insurance office is a place of public accommodation, but not the policy itself, because there's no nexus between the claims about a policy and the actual physical place of public accommodation, the office space. And so they said that Title III did not cover this particular discriminatory policy that the plaintiff was raising. And you'll see that we have cases from Ohio, the Parker case, and from New Jersey, the Ford case, which found the same thing. No nexus between policies and physical place, so the ADA was not applicable. Now we get to a case that's interesting because it turns on one word, and that is the word of, O-F. hard to believe that a simple word like of would make such a difference, but it does. So in the Pelosi case, what we have here are plaintiffs who claim that Allstate refused to sell them insurance policies because of their mental illness and that that was a violation of the ADA. And Allstate said, we're not covered by Title III. The ADA references insurance offices, not insurance companies. Therefore, Congress intended the ADA to cover physical access to facilities of insurance providers, not prohibit discrimination against people with disabilities in insurance underwriting. And the Second Circuit found that the defendant's arguments were unpersuasive. They said that the definition of public accommodation says goods and services, therefore it's more than physical access relying on car parts. And what the Second Circuit then did was they actually looked at the language of public accommodation, and it says, Title III requires the full and equal enjoyment of the goods, services, facilities, privileges, advantages, or accommodations of, there's the key word, of any place or public accommodation. And they said the word of is distinct from the word in. So we're not talking about in a place, we're talking about of a public accommodation. And they said that Title III could apply to the sale of insurance policies even if the policies were sold outside of the insurance office. So you'll see this of in distinction coming up in other cases, and this is the first one out of New York that really said this. Now the next case we're going to talk about is important, but it's not an insurance case, but it's one that's been relied upon as well. And this is a case, you might remember it, it got a lot of press when it came down, a Rendon case out of Florida, and this was some folks who had hearing impairments as well as mobility disabilities. They wanted to be on the show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? Remember that show with Regis Philbin? It was, you know, really big deal back at the sort of the turn of the century. And they had to get on this show, you had to go on to some sort of contestant hotline. It was called the Fast Finger Game. And it basically was trying to see if you could, you know, answer questions really quickly. The problem was this game that you would do on when you tried to do this Fast Finger Game, it screened out people with disabilities. And so the issue here was, is the contestant hotline a place of public accommodation? And the 11th Circuit said, well, yeah, the quiz show itself is a place of public accommodation because it falls within the theaters and other places of entertainment category, one of those 12 categories. And they said that Title III doesn't require discrimination to occur on site. The fact that the plaintiffs in this suit were screened out by an automated telephone system rather than by admission policy administered at the studio door was of no consequence under the statute. And therefore, they found that Title III was not limited to physical barriers, but also intangible barriers, such as eligibility requirements. So what we've found now, as we're looking at moving on to the website cases, is there are really two types of website cases. Websites that are used by traditional brick and mortar establishments. So this is where there really is a store, some sort of actual physical place, and they have a website. And the question is that website covered by the ADA when it is connected to an actual physical business? But also, what about businesses that are housed exclusively online? There's certainly plenty of businesses these days that have no physical site that you go to. You only go to access their information via a website. Now, if you go way back to 1996, even though DOJ hasn't issued actual regulations on website accessibility, there is an interesting letter that was written by the Assistant Attorney General Deval Patrick, and this was a letter he wrote to Senator Tom Harkin, who had a constituent had contacted Senator Harkin raising the question of the applicability of the ADA to the Internet. So Mr. Patrick responded to Senator Harkin with a letter, and at the bottom of this slide you'll see a link to that letter. But basically that letter is very clear that DOJ considered websites to be covered by the ADA and said that covered entities under the ADA are required to provide effective communication regardless of whether they generally communicate through print media, audio media, or computerized media such as the Internet. Covered entities that use the Internet for communications regarding their programs, goods, or services must be prepared to offer those communications through accessible means as well. So they really tie it to the whole concept under the ADA of effective communication that we see throughout Title III. That was really a key to DOJ's analysis. And while the letter didn't actually address directly ADA coverage for businesses operating exclusively online, it did squarely state that otherwise covered entities that use the Internet must ensure that their websites are accessible. One of the first cases we had for website accessibility, as you might remember, was Access Now versus Southwest Airlines out of Florida. And this is a case where some folks were claiming that the website wasn't accessible, there was no alternative text to communicate content displayed visually on the website, the online forms weren't accessible, and there was no skip navigation link that permitted customers to bypass the navigation bar on the website. And the court said, well, sorry, we don't think that the website itself is a place of public accommodation. And they looked back at the Rendon analysis, but they said that Title III governs solely access to physical, concrete places of public accommodation and doesn't apply to virtual spaces like Southwest.com. And so they found there was no indication that the website's barrier were somehow linked to any specific physical or concrete space, and therefore the case was dismissed because there was no connection, no nexus to a physical space when you went on the website. The Target case is another case that got a lot of publicity, and this was filed out in California. And you remember we had that precedent in California, the Wire case requiring a physical place. So that comes into play here. And this lawsuit was claiming that the accessibility problems on Target's website were a violation of the ADA. They had problems with alt text, navigating without a mouse, and problems with navigation links that were not accessible. And the court said that because they were in the Ninth Circuit, they are bound by Wire, and they needed to be this physical nexus component. But then they also looked at the Pelosi case and talked about how this language of versus in, and they said that Title III applies to the services of a public accommodation, not services in a place of public accommodation. So what they ended up doing is sort of splitting things up. First, they said that we're going to allow the case to go forward as long as there's a connection to things that are offered in the Target stores. And so if they're offering things on the website that are also in the Target stores, those things are covered. But if there are things on the website that are not connected to the Target store, there's not a nexus to a physical place, those claims cannot proceed. And so they said to limit the ADA to discrimination in the provision of services occurring on the premises of a public accommodation would contradict the plain language of the statute, that whole comprehensive solution to disability discrimination that we talked about before. Soon after the court ruled, Target did reach an agreement with the plaintiffs here, and they agreed to modify their website to ensure that blind guests using screen reader software could acquire the same information as those who are sighted guests. And I think ultimately they didn't have certain parts of the website that were inaccessible that weren't connected to Target. I mean, they were required to make the whole website accessible. But we still do have that language from the underlying case that makes a distinction between connection to what's in the physical place and things that aren't, and that being a distinction on when the ADA applies and when it doesn't. Target also paid considerable damages, $6 million to the class, and also provided money to a nonprofit that served people who are blind. So now let's talk about internet-only businesses. And one of the first cases that was brought was National Federation of the Blind versus AOL. And what the folks argued here was that AOL's browser interfered with the ability for individuals who are blind from using their screen reader software. They weren't compatible. However, before the case was decided, the parties actually settled the case. So we don't have any court decision that's going to talk about whether or not AOL was covered by the ADA or not. But you do have a link to a settlement agreement where they talk about AOL agreed to establish an accessibility policy. They were supposed to consult with the disability community, and then they made sure that their newest version, at the time I think it was AOL 6.0, would be compatible with screen readers within 4 to 8 months. The next case we wanted to highlight is called Hooks versus OK Bridge, Inc. And this is a case out of Texas, and it involved somebody who had bipolar disorder who sued an internet-only business. It was an online bridge tournament site. And this plaintiff wasn't claiming website was inaccessible, but he claimed he was kicked off this website because of his disability. And so he sued the business, and they raised the same claim that they're not covered by the ADA. And the court granted the business's motion for summary judgment and found that the website was not a place of public accommodation, and the services over the internet was not a place of public accommodation for services provided over the internet because there was not a physical space. They also talked about that the website was a private membership club, The case went up to the Fifth Circuit, but they ended up deciding on other grounds. But the lower court decision did say that the website was not a place of public accommodation. One reason we wanted to highlight this case, though, is because DOJ wrote one of their initial amicus briefs on the website accessibility being covered by the ADA and put some real clear language of their position here. And they said that limiting Title III to entities that provide services on-site would be an arbitrary and irrational limitation on the coverage that conflicts with the clear and important purposes of the Act. And they talked about that there's catchphrases in the public accommodation section, like other service establishment, that makes it clear that it should be provided, that coverage should be beyond physical space, but also include services in clients' homes, over the telephone, and in the internet. And they said that, you know, oftentimes when you'll see courts applying old words to new technology, and they talked about how even the Supreme Court has applied the First Amendment's principles of freedom of speech to new mediums like the internet, even though obviously there was no internet when the First Amendment was drafted. So we have a link to the brief there that gives a lot of detail and of DOJ's position on this. I think can be very helpful if this is something you want to explore further. And DOJ expressly in this brief rejected precedents that said that Title III is limited to physical spaces and rejected the Wire case as well as the Parker and the Ford cases we talked about before. So even though there's no rules yet from DOJ, it's clear their position is that the ADA is covers the Internet. You'll probably remember this case. It got a lot of press, a case against Netflix by the National Association of the Deaf, and they were claiming that Netflix was violating the ADA because their streaming content was not accessible. It was not captioned. And this is another case where DOJ got involved, filed a very extensive statement of interest. We've got a link there, and they again make very clear that the ADA is covered, that websites are covered by the ADA. After this decision, the Netflix case settled, they agreed to provide 100% of their content. And when the court denied the motion to dismiss, I skipped this part, sorry, they agreed with DOJ and said that they relied upon carports and said that places of public accommodation aren't limited to actual physical structures. And they said that Netflix falls within at least one of the enumerated categories. They looked at service establishments, places of exhibition entertainment, and rental establishment. And they rejected the argument that Title III can't cover services that are provided in private residences, which is one of the things that Netflix had argued at the time. They said while homes themselves are not public accommodations, entities that provide services in the home may qualify as a public accommodation. And the case, I think, also reaffirms that Title III covers the services of a public accommodations, not just services in or at a public accommodation, how we've seen in the other cases. That language was in this case decision as well. You'll see that most of the other cases brought against Internet-only businesses have been brought in the Ninth Circuit, which, as we talked about before, under the Wire case, requires this nexus to a physical space. And so we've got a lot of cases coming up that I'll go through quickly that show they were dismissed because they couldn't show this connection. And in fact, there was a month after the Netflix decision in Massachusetts, there was a Netflix decision in a case brought in California that went the other way and said that, you know, they have to adhere to Ninth Circuit precedent. And because there isn't a connection between Netflix and a physical place, they're not covered by the ADA. So we saw two different Netflix interpretations in different parts of the country. Some other cases that we've seen, cases brought against Facebook, cases brought against Google, YouTube, and MySpace, that really said the same thing, is that these businesses all operate in cyberspace, and there's no connection to a physical space, so they're not covered by the ADA. Now, if this has been brought out in the First Circuit, out in the New England area, we might have gotten very different results. And then the other case we wanted to mention to you is a case against eBay. This was somebody who was deaf, and she could not register as a seller on eBay because eBay's automated telephone verification system was inaccessible. So the complaint was actually not about access to the eBay website, but inaccessibility of the phone registration system. But when she sued eBay because they are an internet-only business and there's not a physical nexus, the court dismissed it under the Wire precedent. So what's next with respect to internet-only businesses? Well, you know, given the number of newly emerging web-only businesses, we're going to expect to see some other cases outside of the First Circuit where we had car parts and the Ninth Circuit where we had the Wire case. And, you know, oftentimes when you have splits in different circuits, sometimes that's the time when the Supreme Court will step in. However, we're hopeful that instead of the Supreme Court stepping in, which, you know, it's unclear how that would go, it would be better if DOJ stepped in and sort of affirmed what they've already said in the advance notice of proposed rulemaking, as well as in their amicus briefs and in their statement of interest about the ADA applying to websites. So we'll see how that plays out. So at this point, we're going to open it up and see if there's any questions, and then answer those quickly, and then move on to some settlement agreements under Title III and the other parts of the ADA. Claudia and Rachel, are there any questions? I don't see any, but I might not be seeing those.
No, I don't see any at this time.
Okay. So why don't we just continue so that Rachel can talk further about Title III and the other parts of the ADA. And if people have questions, go ahead and type those in, and we'll get to those when her presentation is complete. Rachel?
Okay, thanks, Barry, and hello to everyone. As Barry mentioned, we're going to turn now to some recent settlement agreements. And we'll start by talking about some agreements reached by the Department of Justice. DOJ has been pretty active in this area lately. So starting with a very recent settlement agreement, which is actually a consent decree between the Department of Justice and H&R Block. And this agreement resolved a lawsuit that was filed by the National Federation of the Blind, some private litigants, and in this case, the Department of Justice actually filed a motion to intervene. So in this lawsuit, the parties had alleged that H&R Block offered a number of services online to its customers, but failed to make those services accessible to people with disabilities for many of those same reasons, those virtual accessibility barriers that we've talked about in the past. And we think it's important to note that just as many companies are now doing, H&R Block's website was not a simple website that provided just basic information like office hours and locations, but instead it was this website that its website and its other electronic products really provided people with the opportunity to a range of things that they otherwise would have had to do in the store. So for instance, online, these individuals were able to prepare and file taxes independently, and they were able to have their taxes prepared in real time. Moving on to the next slide. So H&R Block ended up entering into a consent decree with the Department of Justice. And this decree discusses accessibility with respect to H&R Block's website, its mobile apps, and its online tax products. Under the terms of the agreement, specifically by January 1st of next year, H&R Block agreed to make its website accessible and its online tax preparation product accessible, satisfying the criteria established in the Web Content Accessibility Guidelines version 2.0. And the agreement notes that H&R Block will meet Level A and AA success criteria. Further, under the terms of the agreement, H&R Block will make all of its mobile apps conform to that same accessibility standard by January 1st of 2016. So before we really get into continue with the terms of the H&R Block agreement, I want to just pause for a moment and give a bit of background on these Web Content Accessibility Guidelines, which are frequently abbreviated as WCAG and pronounced. We've heard anything from WCAG to WCAG, but just for consistency today, we're going to call them WCAG. And as Barry mentioned, we are not experts in these technical requirements, and I'm sure there's people on the phone with a very wide range of understanding of what these standards are. But I just thought it was important to give everyone a quick background on what these standards are, because we're going to be using them over and over again when we talk about the different settlement agreements today. So essentially, WCAG is a series of guidelines about how to make a website accessible. They're published by the Web Accessibility Initiative, which is part of the World Wide Web Consortium. The first version of WCAG was published in 1999, and then version 2.0 was published in 2008. And the way they work is that WCAG 2.0 has 12 guidelines, and each of these guidelines is intended to make a website more usable for people with disabilities. And there's three different levels of conformance. There's A, AA, and AAA, with A being the minimal level and AAA being the maximum level. So when we talk about WCAG today, as we discuss these agreements, that's essentially what we're referring to. As Barry mentioned, we do have a slide towards the very end of the presentation that has a lot more information about WCAG and other sorts of technical guidance for those who are interested in learning more about the technical aspects. Okay, moving back into the H&R Block agreement. H&R Block also agreed to adopt a web access policy, which outlines its requirements moving forward. And under the terms of the policy, H&R Block agreed to make its technology accessible, as we just discussed, but they also agreed to solicit feedback on how to do that, to actually talk to people and figure out how to best provide greater accessibility. H&R Block agreed to distribute this policy on an annual basis and to designate a web accessibility coordinator. But there's more. H&R Block agreed to annually assess and review its accessibility, to regularly conduct automated tests for accessibility, to enlist people with disability to test for accessibility, and finally, to hire a web access consultant to evaluate accessibility and provide a report identifying barriers and providing recommendations. So as you can see, this is a pretty comprehensive policy. So the question we have for you on the slide is, so what's the impact of this agreement? Well, Barry talked about the split in the case law about internet-only businesses. But of course, H&R Block's a traditional place of public accommodation, so the agreement doesn't add a great deal to that debate. However, given the breadth and this comprehensive nature of this agreement and the fact that it applies to websites, mobile apps, and other electronic products, it's a good indication of where DOJ is going with their enforcement efforts. So for all those businesses who are out there, we really think that this consent decree can be used as a valuable tool. We encourage businesses to take a close look at this web access policy and use it to help them adopt and revise their own accessibility policies. A copy of the consent decree and specifically the web access policy can be found on DOJ's website when the link is on this slide. Note that the web access policy is actually attached to the consent decree as Exhibit A. Okay, so unlike the H&R Block agreement, which was exclusively about electronic accessibility, DOJ has also entered into a number of other recent agreements that include web access as one of many components to the settlement. So we just wanted to highlight a couple of those. First, we've got the agreement with Newseum. The Newseum is a museum in Washington, D.C., and the Newseum agreed to ensure that the visual and audio contents of its website would conform to WCAG 2.0 level AA. Likewise, we've got the Cleveland Cavaliers, who agreed to update their website to comply with WCAG 2.0 AA criteria. In addition to updating their website, the Cavs agreed to develop a written policy to regularly assess their site for compliance and to advertise a contact so that if people with disability do encounter barriers, they know who to reach out to. And interestingly, the agreement also excludes third-party content. That's content such as advertising that's actually on the site but it's not controlled by the Cavs. And as we continue to review some of these settlement agreements today, we'll see this type of carve-out throughout a number of the agreements that we discussed, but to varying degrees. So another lesson that I think we can all learn from some of these recent DOJ agreements is that DOJ is pretty comfortable with WCAG 2.0. It's what they've included as the proper accessibility standard in a number of their recent agreements. So as Barry mentioned, we do not yet have regulations on website accessibility, but the fact that DOJ has included WCAG 2.0 level AA in a number of their settlement agreements is a pretty good indication that if businesses do comply with these standards, they're much, much less likely to have providing accessibility and B, to be in a position where they're not going to be defending themselves in a lawsuit or a DOJ complaint. But of course, DOJ is not the only group active in this area of the law. I wanted to highlight a couple of the recent results where the American Council of the Blind, or ACB, and its state affiliate, and the American Federation for the Blind have entered into a number of agreements through structured negotiations and have been represented by attorneys Lainey Feingold and Linda Dardarian in a number of these efforts. So for those out there who are unfamiliar with structured negotiations, it's essentially a legal strategy where instead of pursuing formal litigation, complainants will contact a company and enter into an agreement to negotiate a resolution to a dispute in good faith. And it's this type of structured negotiations that have resulted in a large number of agreements regarding website accessibility. So starting with a couple, we've got two large drugstore chains, CVS and Rite Aid, both of which agreed to make their website accessible. CVS agreed to use best efforts to ensure that all pages on CVS.com substantially complied with the WCAG guidelines. CVS also hired a consultant to audit its website and issue a final audit report to the parties. And note, again, just like we had in that earlier agreement with the CABS, CVS is not required to make all third-party content accessible. But there is kind of a caveat to that, and that is when CVS issues requests for proposals or enters into a contract regarding third-party content moving forward, it agrees to make a good faith effort to locate and select contractors and vendors who are able to comply with the WCAG guidelines. Likewise, we've got this agreement with Rite Aid, and it had pretty substantially similar terms regarding compliance with WCAG and the exclusion of third-party content that we saw in CVS. But we wanted to point out in the Rite Aid agreement that there's a specific discussion about the site's use of CAPTCHAs. CAPTCHAs, for those who are unfamiliar, are those visual security measures that are used by many sites intended to confirm whether the user is human. You know, the way it works is that there's a visual image shown, sometimes letters or numbers or a combination, and then the user needs to properly identify the correct content. The problem with these CAPTCHAs is that, as originally designed, they were inaccessible to screen readers given their visual nature. So under the terms of the Rite Aid agreement, Rite Aid agreed to use alternative measures to maintain security, but in a way that's accessible to the blind and visually impaired community. At the time of the agreement, the complainants tested the CAPTCHA in use and found it to be accessible. But then the settlement agreement also looks into the future and states that if Rite Aid does choose to use a different CAPTCHA, it needs to give people with disabilities and the complainants the opportunity to test it before doing so. And although it's not the topic of today's webinar, we do want to point out that both the Rite Aid and the CVS agreement also require these drugstores to make their point of sales devices accessible. Point of sales devices are those small devices used at checkout counters to swipe your credit card, enter your PIN information. And again, as originally invented, those devices lacked any sort of tactile features, which made them inaccessible to a number of individuals who are blind. So these agreements, in addition to providing for website accessibility, required the provision of accessible devices with tactile keys, which of course is very important for people with disabilities who are now able to enter their own financial information securely, privately, and also independently. There are a number of other agreements regarding website access that have been achieved through structured negotiations, including ones with Radio Shack, Safeway, and Staples. And in all of these agreements, those companies agreed to make their website accessible to people with disabilities. So when reviewing a number of these settlement agreements, it's kind of interesting to compare and contrast the similarities and the differences. And one thing that stood out to us is that over time, the web accessibility standards that were designated in the settlement agreements actually changed. So for instance, in some of the older agreements, like the Radio Shack agreement, which was entered into in 2007, WCAG 1.0 was designated as the appropriate standard. But then moving forward a couple years to the CVS and Rite Aid agreements from 2008 and 2009, the entities were able to choose which of the standards they wanted to use, WCAG 1.0 or WCAG 2.0. And then most recently, we've got the Safeway agreement, which was from just a couple of years ago, and there WCAG 2.0 was designated as the appropriate standard. So, you know, this is just an indication that just like the technology itself, technology accessibility standards are bound to change over time as well. And this is, you know, the living nature of this is important to keep in mind when negotiating for outcomes and entering into agreements on this issue. Okay, staying on the topic of settlement agreements, but focusing now at making a shift to agreements with respect to websites that are housed exclusively online. One of the first settlements with a business, an online-only business, after that AOL settlement that Barry mentioned earlier, was an agreement with Amazon.com, which was reached in 2007. The National Federation of the Blind was represented by the organization Disability Rights Advocates, and they used the strategy, again, of structured negotiations to reach this agreement. And Amazon agreed to make Amazon.com accessible, as well as a number of its affiliated websites. Additionally, Amazon created an accessibility committee recognizing that accessibility remains a priority as new internet technology develops. And another element of the settlement we found noteworthy is that the agreement specifically addresses the situation of new technology. You know, as again, as explained before, technology is constantly changing, so it's important to consider accessibility as this new technology develops. And this agreement recognizes that, and they actually have a provision that says, you know, the parties will agree to cooperate with one another and identify and potentially implement solutions to accessibility barriers posed by new technology in the future. So from an outside perspective, this seems to be such a great way to continue the relationship between the parties, keep the conversation going, and ensure accessibility for people with disabilities, even in the face of new and changing technology. So interestingly, state attorneys general have also been another group that have entered into settlement agreements with internet-only businesses. In 2004, the New York Attorney General he stated that, in his opinion, private websites have to be accessible to people with disabilities, and entered into an agreement with Priceline.com, also working with the American Federation of the Blind. As a result of that agreement, Priceline agreed to implement a number of accessibility standards required by WCAG. And then more recently, in 2013, the Massachusetts Attorney General entered into an agreement with the National Federation of the Blind and Monster Worldwide. As a result of this agreement, job seekers who are blind will have full and equal access to Monster.com, including Monster's mobile applications. The last agreement that we're going to talk about before moving into Title II is another result of structured negotiations. Here we've got Major League Baseball, and they agreed to make MLB.com and each MLB club site, such as Cubs.com, accessible in an agreement with the ACB and two of its state affiliates. This is a more recent settlement agreement, so it designates WCAG 2.0 level AA as the proper accessibility standard. And interestingly, in addition to their traditional websites, MLB also agreed to ensure that the content delivered through its game day audio player, its related media center, as well as its radio streams and television streams satisfy those same criteria. We've talked today about emerging technology, and this settlement is another good example of the changing times. So this settlement was entered into in 2009, and again, it covered so many things. It was certainly very comprehensive. But then came the emergence of another new technology, specifically mobile apps. So in 2012, the parties all got back together, and they executed an addendum in which MLB agreed to make its mobile application accessible pursuant to WCAG 2.0. And on this slide, we've got links to the settlement agreements, and on all of the slides, we've got links to the different settlement agreements mentioned today. Okay, moving on to websites and Title II of the ADA. And as most, I'm sure everyone here knows, Title II covers state and local governments. So again, let's start by looking at some of the language of Title II. It says that qualified individuals with disabilities shall not be excluded from participation in or be denied the benefits of the services, programs, or activities of a public entity. So we have the same question that we had under Title III, which is, are websites required to be accessible under Title II? So unlike Title III, there really haven't been a ton of cases assessing this under Title II. We'll talk about one 2002 case in a moment that found that, yes, the site needed to be accessible. And like its position on Title III, the Department of Justice has had a very clear position on this for many years. In 2003, it published a technical assistance guide called Accessibility of State and Local Government Websites to People with Disabilities. And in this document, it explains that state and local governments need to provide equal access to their programs, services, and activities, unless doing so would be a fundamental alteration or would impose an undue burden. So DOJ explains that one way to help meet these requirements is to ensure that a government website has accessible features. In this document, the DOJ notes that, you know, theoretically, an agency with an inaccessible site could meet its legal obligations through alternative measures, such as staffing a phone line, but those types of alternatives are unlikely to provide an equal degree of access in terms of hours of operation and the range of options available. So just as an example, you know, websites exist 24/7. So if a government entity doesn't have an accessible site, it would need to be considering how to provide an alternative method to provide that information 24/7 as well, which of course is probably much more difficult and costly than making its website accessible. More recently, in 2010, in its advance notice of proposed rulemaking, the DOJ was pretty blunt in its statement that said that there is no doubt that the websites of state and local government entities are covered by Title II of the ADA. So not leaving much room for ambiguity there. I mentioned that there's not a ton of case law on this issue, but the case law that does exist is consistent with the DOJ's position. So we've got this case, Martin versus Metro Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority, which is a 2002 case. In this case, the plaintiffs were both individuals with mobility-related disabilities and individuals with vision-related disabilities. And the plaintiffs alleged that MARTA had violated the ADA in a number of ways. They had allegations about wheelchair access on buses, broken elevators. But among those other allegations, the plaintiffs asserted that MARTA had failed to provide information through its website in an accessible format. So they moved for a motion, they moved for preliminary injunction, and the court granted that preliminary injunction. In doing so, the court held that the information available on MARTA's website was not equally available to people with disabilities. And in the court's opinion, until MARTA's website was accessible, MARTA was violating the ADA mandate of making adequate communications capacity available through accessible formats and technology to enable users to obtain information and schedule service. So some of this language came from the Department of Transportation regulations, but the court also cited a number of more general Title II language as well. Staying on the topic of Title II, the Department of Justice has entered into a number of recent settlement agreements with Title II entities about inaccessible websites. Recently, just this past July, DOJ entered into an agreement with Orange County Clerk of Courts in Florida, resolving a complaint that had originated from a private attorney. Here, the attorney had alleged that the clerk had violated the ADA by denying him full and equal access to documents posted on the court's electronic docket. Here, the attorney had asked repeatedly for documents to be filed in an accessible format so that he would be able to access them. He filed a motion with the court, and for months and months, the attorney was unable to access the documents. So the Department of Justice conducted an investigation and concluded that, yes, indeed, the clerk had discriminated against the complainant by denying him the full and equal participation in and denying him the benefits and services of the programs activities of the clerk of the courts. So as a result, DOJ entered into a settlement agreement with the clerk, and they agreed to a number of things. First, the settlement discusses this electronic filing system, and the parties agreed to establish a policy so that people with disabilities would be able to request court documents to be provided in an accessible format. And the agreement also says that once it's clear that a person with a disability is a participant in a case, either as a party or an attorney or in another capacity, the clerk will ensure that all of the documents filed in that case on that electronic filing system will be provided to the individual in an accessible format. So that it's nice that then it's that way the individual doesn't have to make continued requests. The clerk also agreed to revise its web pages and its web apps so that they all comply with the requirements of WCAG 2.0. In addition to its own sites, the clerk also agreed that all other websites owned, operated, branded, or funded by the clerk would be accessible as well. And finally, the clerk agreed to designate a person who is responsible for electronic and website access and to provide training on WCAG 2.0 to all of its employees and contractors with any responsibility related to website accessibility. DOJ has tackled this issue of website access through its Project Civic Access initiatives as well. For those unfamiliar, Project Civic Access is an initiative where DOJ will go in and evaluate all aspects of a city or a town and enter into a comprehensive agreement to improve accessibility. And in the more recent Project Civic Access agreements, DOJ has included requirements for website access. So just to highlight one, in this recent agreement with City of Fort Morgan, Colorado, the city agreed to annually distribute that 2003 DOJ technical assistance document I mentioned. The city also agreed to post online a policy that its web pages would be accessible and to create a process to make those pages accessible. The city agreed to make all of its new and modified web pages accessible and to make its existing web content accessible. The city agreed to post its telephone number or an email address so that visitors could request accessible information. And finally, the city agreed to at least annually enlist people with disabilities to test their pages for compliance. So DOJ has reached these similar agreements with a number of other cities and towns. But on this slide, we have got a couple of additional examples, one with the town of Poostenkill in New York and with the city of West Columbia in South Carolina. One distinction that we noticed between some of these examples is while that agreement with the city of Fort Morgan, requires all existing pages to be accessible, some of these other agreements that are a bit older require governments to agree to develop and implement a plan to make existing web content more accessible. So ultimately getting to the same goal, but potentially with a little bit less strong language. And another thing that we notice is that unlike these Title III settlements that DOJ enters into that specify the appropriate web accessibility standard, a lot of the Project Civic Access agreements don't include a specific reference. But again, they do reference that DOJ technical assistance document, which in turn references both the WCAG guidelines and the Section 508 standards, which we'll talk about in a few minutes and come from the Rehabilitation Act. So in addition to these traditional Title II and Title III entities that we just spoke about, there have been a number of agreements with organizations in specific industries. We wanted to go through a couple of them quickly. So for instance, colleges and universities are an industry that have been working on the issue of website accessibility. And they've actually been working on it with both the Department of Justice and the Department of Education. And again, while it's not the topic of today's webinar, we wanted to make sure that those folks out there are aware that a lot of the agreements with colleges and universities, in addition to addressing the issue of website accessibility, also address the issue of accessible course materials and accessible distance learning programs. So again, there are a number of examples of these, but just to highlight a recent agreement entered into between the Department of Justice and Louisiana Tech. Under this agreement, Louisiana Tech agreed that all of its new and redesigned web pages, apps, and web content will comply with WCAG 2.0. All of its existing pages, Louisiana Tech agreed to develop a plan to make its pages accessible by a specific date that gave itself about a year. And when making its existing content accessible, the university is going to prioritize pages with the most important information or pages that are used the most frequently. So I think that's a good tip also for entities out there that are kind of going step by step and changing existing web pages to really figure out a good order of how to do it. The healthcare industry is another field where accessible websites are really important to people with disabilities. So we wanted to highlight two initiatives in the healthcare field. First, we've got an initiative from WellPoint, which is a large health benefits company. WellPoint agreed about 6 months ago that it was making its affiliated health plan websites, mobile apps, and print information accessible for all people with disabilities by adopting the WCAG 2.0 as its accessibility standard. And then second, the American Cancer Society, as a result from its structured negotiations with the American Council for the Blind, agreed to use its best efforts to ensure that its website substantially complies with WCAG 2.0, criteria level AA. And then this agreement, like we've seen in some of the others, have specific requirements for to ensure the accessibility of PDF documents and of CAPTCHAs. The final industry-specific agreement we wanted to mention today are those with the financial services institutions. And just to highlight this first one, which is Carl Schwab Settlement Agreement, which was entered into in 2012. Again, Charles Schwab agreed to make its client website accessible pursuant to WCAG 2.0. And, you know, we've seen a lot of these agreements that exclude third-party content, and this agreement does still have that exclusion, but it does have some stronger requirements than some of the others, so we wanted to walk through those. In this agreement, if third-party content is inaccessible, Charles Schwab will request that the third party bring their content into compliance, and then if the third party fails to do so, Charles Schwab will make good faith efforts to find an alternate vendor. And then in addition, all future requests for proposals for development or inclusion of third-party content will require compliance with WCAG 2.0. And of course, one reason we wanted to include a few examples of agreements in the financial services industry is really to reiterate once again the reasons why website accessibility is so important. You know, so many people nowadays do their banking online, and it enables us to handle our own money and our own time, and without accessible banking, people with disabilities were forced to rely on others to handle matters as important and private as money. So in addition to the agreement we just mentioned, we've got a number of other agreements listed on this page with LaSalle Bank, Bank of America, First Union, Bank One, Fleet Bank, Washington Mutual that address both issues of website accessibility and of accessible ATMs, or as they've come to be known as talking ATMs. Okay, moving on to Title I, our last ADA section. Title I prohibits employers from discriminating against qualified individuals with disability in all aspects of employment, but including the job application process, advancement, and discharge. And you know, there are a number of cases that could arise under Title I. So for example, if an employer required all of its job applicants to apply for employment via an application on an inaccessible website, well, that could lead to an ADA case about website accessibility. Or nowadays, many employers are using online tests to screen employees. Given that a lot of those tests themselves are inaccessible, that too could lead to an ADA case. We're not aware of any decisions with the interplay between Title I and website accessibility. So if you know of one, please send it our way. But we expect to see more and more of these types of cases in the future, given employers' continued reliance on these types of electronic applications and in electronic tests. Of course, a webinar about website accessibility couldn't be complete without at least some mention of the Rehabilitation Act. In 1998, Congress amended the Rehab Act and required federal agencies to make their websites and electronic information accessible to people with disabilities. The U.S. Access Board was charged with creating these standards and came up with what's come to be known as the Section 508 standard. But again, like Title I, there hasn't been significant litigation on this topic to date. But you know, these laws are out there and you know, important for folks to pay attention to. In addition to the ADA and the Rehab Act, we just want to make sure businesses and government entities are aware of the other laws that may apply to them. First, many states have their own laws prohibiting discrimination against people with disabilities, and many of those laws are actually specific to website accessibility. So, for example, in Illinois, there is a requirement for website accessibility specific to Illinois agencies and universities. So it is important to know what's out there in your state. Second, there's also industry-specific laws. So we wanted to highlight a couple. The first is, while it's not yet technically a law, there has been a bill proposed, a legislation pending in Congress called the TEACH Act. And the goal of this legislation is to improve accessible education technology for college students with disabilities. If it's enacted, the TEACH Act would require the Access Board to develop guidelines for the accessibility of electronic instructional materials and information technologies at colleges and universities. Airlines also need to be aware of the new Department of Transportation regulations about website access, meaning that, yes, despite the Southwest Airlines prevailing in its earlier case, they now, under these Department of Transportation regulations, do have a legal requirement to make their website accessible. Under these regulations, which were promulgated in late 2013, airlines had 2 years from that date to modify its websites, its web pages with core travel information, and then they have 3 years to modify all other remaining information. The DOT regulations specify WCAG as the proper standard, and they answer a question which is frequently asked when we're talking about transportation entities, and that's, well, whether foreign airlines have to comply with this law as well. And DOT says that, yes, foreign airlines and U.S. airlines need to comply so long as a foreign airline has a website that markets air transport to U.S. consumers for travel within, to, and from the United States. The regs also say that ticket agents must disclose and offer web-based discount fares to customers who are unable to use their websites due to a disability, and that requirement actually stays in place even after a website complies with WCAG. So they want to make sure that anything that's offered online, even once it's accessible, is available to people, to all people with disabilities. Okay, so we've talked a great deal today about WCAG. So for those of you who are interested in learning more about the technical requirements, we've got a number of resources listed on this page, including links to the guidelines themselves and to the technical assistance materials. Similarly, on this slide, we've got links to the Section 508 standards and technical assistance about those 508 standards. And finally, there are a number of resources out there that can help evaluate a website for accessibility. And we encourage all covered entities who aren't sure whether your website's compliant to review some of these sites. There's many more out there, but we specifically wanted to direct everyone's attention to the first bullet point here, which is the World Wide Web Consortium's compilation of a list of various sites. So it includes a number of different tools that will help assess a website for accessibility. And of course, the ADA National Network provides technical assistance on certain website access issues. So you can always contact your regional center at 1-800-949-4ADA or www.adata.org. So just to wrap up before we get into questions, of course, the internet has completely changed the way we live our lives. And despite the broad mandate against discrimination that was included in the ADA, some sites still remain inaccessible to people with disabilities due to virtual accessibility barriers. So as we've reviewed today, there's a debate in the courts about whether Title III applies to websites. But regardless of whether of the case law, it's clear that DOJ considers all commercial websites to be places of public accommodation subject to the ADA's requirements. And of course, many businesses recognize the business reasons to make their website accessible as well. They've got more access to more customers. But still, you know, we all eagerly await the publication of the Department of Justice's Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, and it'll be interesting to see how the publication of that changes the landscape on this issue. And of course, given the importance of websites to our society and the barriers that can prevent accessibility, this is definitely an issue that's going to continue to grow in importance in the years to come. So thank you all for your participation today. Before we start addressing some questions, I just wanted to remind everyone that attorneys interested in CLE credit can contact Barry at barryt@equipforequality.org. And participants, non-attorneys, looking for other sort of continuing education credit can contact the Great Lakes ADA Center. So with that, I think we have a few questions.
And I just want to remind participants, if you're on the telephone, you can send your questions via email to webinars@ada-audio.org. And we'll feed those to the presenters as well during this Q&A segment.
So right now I'm seeing one question that came in, and I think this came in before I discussed this section, but I'm just going to reiterate it. And the question is, are there other laws that apply to website access? And so the answer to that is yes. In addition to the ADA, we've got the Rehab Act, and then there's also those other DOT regulations, the proposed legislation, some relevant state laws, and there may be other things out there as well, but that's, you know, a number of other laws that are out there besides the ADA. And that's the only question I'm seeing. Claudia, is there anything else?
Yeah, so we have a question here. It says, what's the most common element of a site that's not accessible? Is it just like working with the screen reader? So this is a little bit of a technical question. I'm not sure if you're able to address it or you want to give it a try.
Well, this is Barry. I mean, I think as we've talked about, there's really all kinds of different things that happen, and I'm not sure there's a common, like the most common barrier that's out there, but certainly what we've tried to do is highlight some of the common barriers that come up. One of those is that you have visual images that have no compatibility with screen readers. There's no alternative text that lets people know what those visual images are, and oftentimes those visual images can be very crucial in understanding the content of the website. And then I think also the other thing that's challenging is when there is videos on websites and that those aren't captioned. And those, I mean, I would say those are two of the most common issues that come up, although there certainly are others as well. Rachel, if you have any additional thoughts.
No, I think that's a good summary. And for those out there who are interested in some of these technical requirements, I encourage you to take a look through the WCAG, especially some of those technical assistance materials. There's some good just kind of boilerplate, like some of the basics. And it's very interesting to really understand for those who have a less technical background just what these barriers are and how they really do have a very real impact, you know, precluding people from being able to access the website.
Okay, I'm seeing another question. Would the website access requirements also apply to Title III sub-recipient of government agencies when federal funding is involved?
Barry, you can add to this if you want. But so if there's federal funding, then that's going to invoke Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. And so I think that in those circumstances, you know, it's going to be kind of similar to the Title III analysis, and the website will have to be, you know, it will likely have to be accessible because it'll be part of the program or service being offered by the organization being funded.
Right. I mean, you can be covered under the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act, Section 504, at the same time. Sometimes there's questions about sort of how that federal funding is applied and whether that means that the Rehab Act is involved. There's a concept, not to get too technical today, but there's a concept that are you funded as a whole or is your entity primarily engaged in education or in social services, in parks and recreation, or health, and depending on what type of entity you are and how you receive the federal funding, that can make a difference. And we're actually currently litigating that case here in Illinois, but you know, generally entities that receive federal funding are going to be covered by the Rehabilitation Act and potentially could also be covered by the ADA at the same time.
Okay. There any other? Yep, there's a flu still coming in. How about medical offices that use telephone valid registration as part of the access records to the website? What can people do to assist people through the registration or register provider services in their area?
I don't quite understand the question. Can you repeat that, Claudia?
Sure. It's kind of a two-pronged thing. How about the medical offices that provide telephone valid registration as part of their method to access records to the website? What can people do to assist the customer through this provider service?
Okay, so it's not clear to me on this question if the website itself isn't accessible or if it's the telephone access that's not accessible to people with disabilities. But I mean, as we talked about, there are situations where an entity's telephone system isn't accessible, and then if they're an internet-only business, that's then the case law that involves internet-only businesses would apply, even though it's the telephone system that's inaccessible and not the actual website. But you know, generally, if the website isn't accessible, they need to have some sort of alternative for people to get access to the information. And as Rachel explained, you know, the websites are generally available 24/7. And if you say you have a comparable service that's by phone where people can get information, but that's not provided 24/7, you know, the argument is that's not the same kind of access. So I think hopefully DOJ will clarify that, but certainly I think there's a strong argument that you need to provide comparable access. And if your phone access isn't providing the same access that your website is, that there is potentially a violation of the ADA.
I think it's also important, although it's not the topic of today's discussion, but if services are being provided by phone, to make sure that folks answering the phone are trained to understand and to respond to a relay call, or if there is some sort of, you know, TTY or video phone number, to make sure that that's publicized in addition to the voice number.
Okay, great. I do have another question. They're asking if you're familiar with any recent cases regarding Title I in Oregon.
Are they talking about Title? Can you tell if they're talking about Title I in the website access case?
No, they don't specify. They're just asking if you know of any recent cases regarding Title I in the Oregon State.
Yeah, I mean, we're really focusing today on website accessibility, and Rachel, you cover Title I, but I don't think we have any cases from Oregon under Title I, right?
We don't. So if there is one out there that we're not aware of, please be sure to send it to us so we can take a look. But we haven't seen any case decisions about Title I and the interplay with website accessibility.
Yeah, and certainly there's plenty of cases brought under Title I on other issues. I'm sure there's a lot of recent cases in Oregon, but we're not focusing on cases outside of website accessibility today.
Okay, I have another person asking if it's possible for the ruling that was stated that websites are not regulated by the ADA to be overturned.
Well, we've got, you know, as we talked about, there's a lot of cases out of the Ninth Circuit, which covers sort of the western part of the country. And oftentimes what people are concerned about is that if there's bad precedent in their circuit, that it can't be overturned. Actually, that's not necessarily the case. What happens in some situations is a lot of the cases that we talked about that relied upon the Ninth Circuit decision were what are called district court cases, or there was the initial trial court decision. What could have happened in those situations is the plaintiff could have chosen to appeal it up to the Ninth Circuit. It's likely the Ninth Circuit would have affirmed the lower court saying that we're bound by precedent, but then you then have the next thing you have is a procedural tactic called a rehearing en banc. And what that means is instead of it just be three judges from the panel of all the judges on the Ninth Circuit, you would be asking for the entire Ninth Circuit to look at the case and look at the underlying precedent and re-examine the precedent and potentially overturn it. Because any precedent that's out there, if it hasn't been on a rehearing en banc, was really the decision of three judges on a particular panel. We had a situation in Illinois in the Seventh Circuit where we had longstanding precedent about reassignment and saying that being placed in a job that you're qualified that was open wasn't an accommodation you could get under the ADA. But the EEOC appealed up the Seventh Circuit and got a rehearing en banc, and en banc, the entire Seventh Circuit panel, all the judges, reverse their existing precedent. So potentially that could be something that could happen in the Ninth Circuit, because you do have it, that's never been requested as far as I know. The other thing that can happen is, and I alluded to this in the presentation, is that if there is a split among the circuits, potentially a case could be petitioned for the Supreme Court to hear. Now, the Supreme Court doesn't take all the cases. It's discretionary where they take it. But one of the reasons they take a case is if there is a split among the circuits. And so you could go through the process of appealing to the Ninth Circuit. If they don't give the rehearing en banc or they affirm the underlying decision, the next step would then to be a petition to the Supreme Court to hear it. And then if the Supreme Court took it, they would ultimately resolve the issue of conflict. As I alluded to, I think the better course of action would be for the Department of Justice to resolve some of these conflicts by clearly issuing some regulations, really clarifying and codifying into regulations what they've said in a lot of their briefs already. And given the way the time works with cases going up to the Supreme Court, that seems like something that would happen more quickly than the Supreme Court resolving this.
Okay, thank you. Here's an interesting one with regarding to online court filings. Is anyone requiring attorneys to post everything in an accessible format?
So actually the case that I had spoken about, or the settlement agreement that I had spoken about, there were requirements by the clerk to post documents in a very specific format, and the format was, in addition to other things, required that the text be searchable and it be OCR or optical resolution compliant, or optical character recognition compliant. And that's one of those things where it's helpful for all parties, because then they can search the documents, but it also is the technology that enables a screen reader to actually read and comprehend the text. So there are some places out there that are making that requirement. I think that there's a good Title II argument that everyone should be doing that, but I'm not sure exactly, you know, to the extent that that's considered, that's actually being done throughout the country.
Okay. Can you explain why someone would be using the WCAG strict level AA instead of level AAA?
I'm not sure that we can answer that question. I don't know, Barry, if you have any additional thoughts. You know, it seems like folks out there are looking at what the Department of Justice is doing. You know, I don't think that, I think, and especially because a lot of these agreements are settlement agreements, they're not agreements that are required by a court, they're agreements where, you know, parties separately are entering into them. So it'll be interesting to see when the Department of Justice does issue its notice of proposed rulemaking, whether there's a discussion about those different technical standards. But I'm not, you know, I don't have a good answer for you about why a lot of the agreements so far are AA instead of AAA. Requirements.
Yeah, I don't have any additional information on that one.
Right, and I do see a lot more technical website questions coming in, and so I like to remind our participants that you can call your local ADA national network at 800-949-4232, and they can walk you through those issues. Some of the regions actually will help you actually do a site evaluation, so if you need assistance, further assistance on the technical side of it, and if you're actually meeting the WCAG requirements, please go ahead and call your local office. With that, I think we're at the bottom of the hour, so I just want to remind everyone, after this session, we're going to send an email with the evaluation. I'm also going to include a copy of the legal brief. This has further information about the cases that Barry and Rachel discussed today. So you can go ahead and download that from the ada-audio.org website. And if you go to the archive page, you'll see a copy of today's presentation in addition to a copy of the legal brief. Also, if anyone's interested in getting certificate of attendance for today's session, please send an email to certificates@adaconferences.org. And I just want to thank Barry and Rachel for today's session. This is a great session, really interesting topic, a very new topic, I think, for this audience. And we hope we can have more of these in the future. I also want to announce that this is the last session for this fiscal year. We're working on putting together a new schedule for the new fiscal year, and that we're going to send an email blast announcing when those are ready and posted to the website. So keep an eye out for that email announcement. So once again, thank you, everyone, and this will conclude today's session. To exit the webinar platform, you can click on the X in the upper right-hand corner. If you're on the telephone, you can just hang up. Thank you, and have a good day. Goodbye.
Thanks, everybody. Appreciate your participation.
Thank you.